Hi, and welcome to the Psychology Sisters podcast.
Just two besties on a quest to normalise the dialogue around mental health. I'm Kat, a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist. In our episodes, we combine our skills, professional and personal experiences with a light sprinkling of science and a dabble of fun to help you to become informed, in control and empowered.
Now let's dive deep into today's episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Welcome. Today, we are talking about the different stages of relationships from honeymoon to doom.
And gloom.
Sounds very depressing.
But it's not.
Amy, how's your week been?
My week. Every time you ask me that, I like jump.
You haven't prepared.
My week has been...
Let me guess, busy.
No, I was thinking of another word.
Good.
My week has been...
Non-stop.
My week's been quite good. I've had quite a good week.
Yeah?
It's been quite balanced, I would say.
You're just trying not to say busy, are you? You're trying to think of any other word but busy. Because I know you're very busy.
No. I've had a good balanced week of seeing friends, work, gym, food... Everything's been quite balanced.
Good. That's really, really good.
How's your week been?
My week has been good. I think the same as you. I'm trying to find a different word for busy. But in 2 weeks' time, we both have holidays.
I'm so excited.
I'm literally counting down. You know when it gets closer to like a holiday and you're like 5 more days, 4 more days, 3 hours.
That anticipatory excitement.
Yeah.
I did a silly thing. I've been counting down. So I was like, it was week eight. I'm like, only 2 more weeks, but it's 3 more weeks because it's...
If it was at the beginning of week eight,
it's three more weeks. I was like, 2 more weeks, woo! And I was like, oh gosh, no, because I have to get through this week and then it's two more weeks.
But are the weeks flying for you?
So fast.
I cannot believe it is September.
Blink and it's gone.
I know. So really, really excited for that. So I'm just counting down.
What are your pit and peak?
Pit and peak. Okay, I was going out to date night last night and I had this hot little dress and I was so excited to wear it. You know when you just have a dress and you just don't know where to wear it? It's one of those dresses. So I literally planned a date night just so I could wear this dress. And I got it off Boohoo, which are quite notoriously cheap and nasty. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to give them a chance. And I wore this dress and I loved it. But as I was heading out the door, I think it's because I have quite broad shoulders and Josh calls me Trapzilla because of my traps. My strap broke off my dress and I couldn't wear my dress anymore. So that was my pit. I was pretty sad. It's a very first world problem.
You just tuck one strap in and be like,
No, because it's quite like a, if it falls off, it like the whole dress falls off.
Oh.
It's not like a, I can just tie it together.
Damn.
So first world problem, it wasn't really that bad. I'm very lucky that it was only that. My peak is, you know what? My peak is that it's a Saturday.
Oh, and what a peak.
Well, I know. What I'm like, it's the weekend. Peak. I think that has made me so happy. It's almost like the weekend is like you're just like, you're so close to going crazy and insane and it's the weekend and it's like, it's like you can take a breath on the weekend. So I just love the weekend. I just love just, you know what? You know what, actually, I've thought of it. My peak is not having to set an alarm this morning.
Oh, yeah.
So it's the little things, you know?
Yeah, it is the little things.
What about you, Hutto? What is your pit and peak of the week?
My peak is that I get to see you today.
Oh, stop. No, I feel bad that I didn't say that.
Yeah, well, so you should. No, my peak is that I get to see you today and spend time with you and have fun mucking around. And my pit is that I did a dump.
Okay, so I love this story.
I go to the gym in the mornings and I always get changed for work in the gym bathrooms. Mm-hmm. So it's always a big rush. No matter how much time I leave, I always, you know, end up rushing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was rushing and for anyone that's had a shower in an anytime gym bathroom knows how steamy and sweaty and the sweat just doesn't stop. You have a shower and then you sweat more. I don't know. It's just so moist and steamy.
There's no
ventilation.
Yeah,
there's no airflow.
And there's no windows
ever. You just sweat so much. Anyway, so I was having a very, very sweaty morning. Everything was moist. Everything was steamy. It was just all going on. I'd packed stockings to wear that day. So I had one leg up on the basin trying to – it's like stuffing – a sausage in a casing, trying to stuff my sweaty, moist leg in my stockings. Anyway, suddenly and shockingly came to my attention that I hadn't locked the door when this middle-aged man barged open the bathroom door while I'm stark naked, one leg sweaty, moist, red. My face is so red. You know, like after you've just worked out and you're steaming, you're sweaty. I was like this roly-poly little sausage with my leg up on the basin trying to stuff my legs in my stockings, and middle-aged man walked right in and we were both horrified at what each other had just seen. It was like, oh!
He was probably like, that was the best part of his week, probably. He was like, yes.
It wasn't pretty. It really wasn't.
I'm sure.
And he couldn't shut the door quick enough. And it took me 20 minutes to pluck up the courage to walk back out of the bathroom.
Ames, that's so hard.
I can no longer go to that anytime gym.
Yeah.
I can't go there again. So
just set on fire. Just start a new life in Mexico.
Buy one-way ticket. Yeah. See you later. That's my pit.
Oh, that's the worst. I know exactly how you feel. Those showers are so steamy. Mm. It's like finishing a workout then walking to a sauna.
Yep. It's basically
the worst.
Save on our sauna fees. So today we are talking about the stages of a intimate relationship. And we're going to be touching on keys to conflict resolution, how to fight effectively, how to keep the passion in a long-term relationship, or more so just how things change in the span of a relationship.
Things do change over a relationship. They do. Yeah. It never, ever, ever stays the same. And we will probably start this off by saying that no relationship is like the other.
No.
So just because someone else has got a 20-month honeymoon doesn't mean that the next person has to have a 20-month honeymoon.
And other couples argue more than some couples. I remember I had this friend and she was with her boyfriend for like 2 years and they never argued.
Wow.
That's almost
abnormal
that you're not. I mean, they had a great relationship. But yeah, for like the first 2 years of their relationship, they didn't have one argument. It was a long honeymoon stage. Really long honeymoon stage. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I know.
Was it long distance?
No. They were in each other's pockets. They were just like best friends.
Wow.
But honeymoon best friends.
Wow. 2 year honeymoon.
Mm. So the honeymoon period can last for up to 2 years.
Yeah.
So being in love is actually quite complex. Most of what I'm going to be talking about today comes from the Gottman's theory, Julie and John Gottman. And they explain how there are three natural phases of love, as well as choices that come into play when we're choosing our partner or choosing to stay with our partner, when love either progresses to a deeper place that lasts for a really long time or deteriorates, bursts into flames and poof, evaporates.
Not to sound over dramatic.
No, not at all. Be dramatic, never. Yeah. So there's phase one, which is the honeymoon phase, or also known as limerence. So this is often the first stage of a relationship, but it's also the first stage of love because we experience the physical symptoms like flushing, trembling, palpitations, like when we get excited. It's almost like we're obsessed. So
it's like the infatuation.
It is the infatuation stage where we'll have like that sexual excitement, often fantasize about that person, and we really fear being rejected. And this isn't actually an easy stage to come by. I think a lot of people assume or generally make the assumption that the honeymoon phase is a really easy phase to fall into. It's actually not, because to have that feeling with someone, you have to have the right smell, the right look, you have to feel right together to actually trigger the hormones and neurotransmitters that accompany that exciting first phase of love. And then once we do feel that with that special person who triggers all those feelings, it's this cascade of hormones and chemicals, which makes us feel like all these exciting, you know, obsessive, can't live without kind of feelings.
I feel like the honeymoon as well, I'm always trying to think back of my honeymoon period, and it was really exciting, but it was also really nerve-wracking because it's not like, oh, we're stable and we're secure and I don't have to worry. We're fine. It's like, are we exclusive? Are we not exclusive? Are they going to write back? Am I not? It's like that very like you're very unstable. That's a very unstable part of the relationship. Like, you might feel really stable when you're with them, but when you're not with them, it's like, oh, what's it going to be? Like, yeah. Lots of questioning as well. Yeah,
because you've got that fear of rejection. It's like, oh, do they like me as much as I like them? Yeah. Like, you don't want to mess it up.
Yeah. Am I coming on too strong? Yeah. I'm at the window. Be cool. Is this too much?
Yeah, definitely. So some of the chemicals and neurotransmitters that get us going in this honeymoon or limerence phase is PEA, otherwise known as the molecule of love, which is a natural form of amphetamine that our bodies produce. Yeah. And our sensuality is set off by pheromones, which help to create a feeling of comfort when we're maybe locked in a physical embrace.
Pheromones, I should know this. That's the smell. Yeah. You give off.
Yep. And so, like, odors.
Classically, that's among the animal population. That signals that, you know, the animal is right for you. But in humans, we still use that, even though it's very sub. It's unconscious, right? It's the unconscious.
Part of our evolutionary. Yeah. And then there's, of course, oxytocin, also known as the love drug or the cuddle hormone. And that compels us to want to get close to that person. So when we are feeling close to someone, that chemical is secreted. It's secreted throughout pituitary gland and stimulates dopamine, estrogen, and vasopressin.
It's almost like you're on a high on all these chemicals, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that why people feel like they are on literally on drugs, because it's like you feel so high of the dopamine, oxytocin.
And that's why you're addicted to it. Mm. That's why you're addicted to that person when you're in the honeymoon phase. And that's why you also, generally speaking, kind of our judgment is a little bit compromised in this phase. So we may ignore some red flags.
A little bit. God, a lot compromised.
Yep. So judgment goes out the window. We ignore the red flags, alarm bells. Or we might even just be super patient and tolerant of things that we would not be tolerant of later on down the track.
Yeah.
So although it may sound simple, this feeling of being in love or limerence or the honeymoon phase is pretty multifaceted, and it's a selected experience. So not, you can't just have that with anyone. Which, I always think is really special.
Yeah. It's a really fun part of the relationship. Yeah. I know sometimes when Josh and I are thinking, I always think back, oh, how fun. Like, I feel like I remember more from that time because it was so emotionally loaded.
Yeah.
When something's emotionally loaded, you're more likely to remember it. We remembered our first date so perfectly. And then after three or four, we just were like, what did we do on that date, that date?
Yeah.
Like, the first part is so so memorable.
The first time you sleep over their house. The first time, you know.
There's lots of firsts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really
exciting. And it's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You get that, like, butterfly feeling, that
electricity.
You know, it's adrenaline.
Yes.
You get like, oh, like, you know, driving to their place and you're like looking at yourself in the mirror like, oh, is there a hair out of place?
Yeah.
Like, you want to be attractive.
The most perfect part of yourself, don't you? You think, I always look like this. This is just me. And then 2 months later,
it's like, hi, this is me, my sweatpants.
It's me again.
That's not a 5 o'clock shadow. That's just some chocolate.
That's just who I am as a person. It's a really fun stage.
It is.
It's really good too. And yeah, and everybody experiences it differently.
So then we have phase two of falling in love or love, which is the building trust phase. And this is a really important phase. So questions we might ask ourselves when we start a relationship or start to develop pretty strong feelings for someone is, can I trust you to be honest with me? Can I trust you to be there for me? Can I trust you to have my back when you're around other people? Can I trust you to fight for us? So trust is this state that occurs when we feel like our partner kind of acts to optimize our best interest, not just for their own. So it's about feeling like our partner isn't just thinking, what can I get out of this for me? That's a big part of trust. And the answer to this question is the basis of a secure or insecure attachment. And I've talked about attachment theory quite in depth in a previous episode. But basically, parents do not have to be perfect. Few parents are perfect. But somewhere in the child's early world, there needs to be someone who shows that child consistency and explicitly that is love and they are lovable. So humans are programmed to seek out what they lack and respond positively to it when they find it. So most arguing and fighting in a relationship happens in the first 2 years, which means the success or failure is based on how we fight. There's a rule of thumb which suggests that if the ratio of positivity to negativity exceeds a 5-1 during an argument, the couple is more likely to be successful.
Wow, that's a lot of positivity.
It's a lot.
Mm.
So if we learn how to fight or learn how to argue effectively, it's not that hard. And there's actually things that when I work with couples or friends or just recommending in general, and Gottman's The Four Horsemen and Antidotes. So the four horsemen, which are things that you want to avoid when you're arguing with your partner, are criticism. So that might be verbally attacking personality or character. So it's making a personal criticism. Attack. Yeah. So we want to avoid that. And the antidote to that is maybe a gentle startup. So talk about your feelings and use I statements. So I felt hurt when you did this, or I felt sad when you did this, as opposed to you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Contempt, which is attacking sense of self, and that the intention behind that is to insult the person. So the antidote to that is building up appreciation. So remind yourself of your partner's positive qualities. Again, that's where the positivity comes back in. We want to make sure we're staying aware and mindful of our partner's qualities and being grateful of the things that they bring to the table, not just focusing on their shortcomings. Defensiveness is another thing that you should try and avoid. So victimizing yourself to ward off perceived attack, and you try and blame the other person, basically.
That's quite common, I think, that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a very easy trap to fall into, is I'm the victim and you've done this wrong, when really it takes two to tango in most arguments.
Yeah.
There's usually both sides of the story.
That's 100%, and that's the antidote. So take responsibility.
Ownership.
Accept your partner's perspective and offer an apology if you may have played a part in something that's happened, because more than likely you have.
People don't just react on their own accord. Usually something has triggered them to make them upset or angry or blah, 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 blah.
Definitely.
I always say there's three sides to the story. Their side, your side, and what actually happened. Yeah. Because it's true. I mean, you kind of get an exaggerated story sometimes from one side.
Yeah, definitely.
You don't always get
the truth. When you're an emotionally charged, like you're in an argument.
Guess what they did? Yeah. Oh my God, what a dickhead.
Yeah.
And then you leave out the bit where you like have done something really wrong too. Because you want to feel that victim. You want the empathy and the sympathy.
Definitely.
And you want the justification that you're right.
Yeah.
I think when I'm saying that to my friends, I'm like, oh, well, guess blah, 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 blah. And I'm seeking the validation from my friends, like, oh, you did the right thing.
Yeah.
When deep down I'm like, oh.
And you want them to be like, yeah, what a jerk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the fourth thing that we should try and avoid is stonewalling. So that's withdrawing to avoid conflict and conveying any kind of disapproval, distance, and separation. So something that you might do as an antidote to that is take a break, spend some time doing something soothing and distracting to look after yourself, as opposed to completely stonewalling the other person.
So the second stage is really characterized by the beginning of conflict. The rose-colored glasses start to come off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the honeymoon period, the other person can do no wrong.
Yeah.
And you generally, I find in the honeymoon period, people really lessen themselves down and they just try to maybe act like how that other person thinks that they want them to act. We're not our full selves in the honeymoon period.
That's exactly right. So also in the honeymoon period, we have a tendency to idolize the other person and, like I said before, minimize or not even notice any kind of irritating differences. And that's actually a biological function, because that phase, the honeymoon phase, is to ensure that the relationship will endure long enough to lead to reproduction. So in the second stage, which is like the initial conflict stage and also our trust building stage, when we talk about love, those irritating differences are now perceived and acknowledged, and you kind of get a real sense of reality of the person that you've chosen to be with. And you might start thinking like, oh, you know, wish they weren't like that, or
how they chew is so annoying, or I hate that they snore, or I hate they take up the whole bed. What might have first been a really cute little quirk is now like, oh, you're driving me crazy.
Yeah. So it's really important, if you choose that you kind of want to work through those irritating little characteristics that we all have, that we work on the foundations of trust. And that's built on, like I said, having your partner's best interest at heart and listening to your partner's pain and turmoil and communicating that. So when they're hurt, everything stops and we listen to them so that they have our undivided attention, and that can really help build trust. Another way to effectively fight is an acronym that I've kind of adopted from Gottman as well, and it's the word attune, and that always sticks in my mind because being attuned to your partner is so important. So A stands for awareness, so awareness of how a partner's feeling. The first T stands for tolerance, that there will always be two valid points in any negative emotion. The second T stands for turning toward your partner's needs. So rather than turning away from your partner when you're arguing, turn towards them, work through it.
No more stonewalling.
No more stonewalling. The U stands for trying to understand your partner's perspective. The N stands for non-defensive listening. And the E stands for empathy. So I love that.
That is really good. Yeah,
I think that's really, really important to remember when you're arguing with someone. And it can be a little bit difficult to try and be like, T, turn towards my partner when you're like.
I think the best thing to do if you're arguing with your partner is to just have a break. Have a time out. Just be like, I need to go. That might sound like stonewalling, but I think we need to emotionally regulate. We need to emotionally regulate, because when we're angry, we're going to say things we regret and things that are going to hurt the other person's feelings. So I think when we're fighting, like, we're not expecting people to be like, oh, attune. Okay, what do I need to do? Because you're not going to remember it.
No. Yeah, so this acronym is just something to be aware of, just to have in the forefront of your mind when you maybe coming up to an argument or you notice there's some tension, just to help argue and fight a little bit more effectively. And that can really help with maintaining a relationship.
Arguing is not a bad thing. I feel like lots of people think that arguing and conflict is negative, but it's actually really needed and essential in relationships in order to solve problems.
Definitely. So that was phase two of love. The next phase three, is building commitment and loyalty. So this is about building real commitment and loyalty to one another. And here is where you make another choice. So here you can either appreciate one another by cherishing and showing gratitude for what you have, or you can build resentment for what you think might be missing. So here you focus on what your partner brings, like special unique qualities, and how grateful you are for the relationship you have together. Or you might shift your focus to what's missing. You might be thinking, think I could do better elsewhere.
Comparison to other couples as well.
Yeah, definitely. And this third phase is really kind of like your do or die phase. Do you nurture the deeper love to last? Or do you slowly kind of start walking away? Or that could even be the building points towards a betrayal in relationships, is when you start harvesting resentment. And there's an important component to phase three called the fairness metric, which is a sense of equal distribution of power. So it's crucial to have a fair balance of power and for each person in the relationship to perceive that there is a fair balance of power to establish a deep and lasting sense of trust in a relationship and to really be able to commit. You need to feel that it's fair. In this, in terms of the relationship stage, the third stage of a relationship, I call the disappointment stage, which sounds quite negative, but it's not.
Pessimistic.
It's the more so the realization that something might need to change. So we might be clinging to the conviction that he or she must change first for the relationship to work. But also during this stage, we start to realize that change needs to come from the self as well. So that can either come from things like arguing or fighting or just having normal conversations, or it might even come out during counseling sometimes. A lot of those things kind of come to the surface.
And I think also with the disappointment phase, you know, similar to the other one, it's like the make or break. It really adds to it as well. It's like, oh, like, is this going to last? Yeah. I think a lot of the questions of, is this going to last? Where's this going? And I wonder if a bit of the pressure of marriage starts to come into it. It might be a stage of anxiety, because it's like, where is this heading? It goes from being, oh, this is so fun and exciting, I love this relationship, to like, okay, what now?
Yeah, because by this stage you've invested a lot of your time and energy and emotion into the relationship, and that kind of honeymoon rose-colored glasses has worn off.
Yeah.
And we're thinking, can I see myself in a long-lasting relationship with this person?
Yeah. It's not that are they perfect, but can you put up with them? Not sounds really awful, but can you live with what they are?
Accept them as a whole.
Yeah.
For everything that they are.
Yeah. Also with the disappointment phase, it's not all disappointing. I mean, I feel like with this phase, it's like the comfortable, it's like the harmonious. It's like you start to work out each other's flaws and work around them and accept them.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, I know that you do the cooking and I do the cleaning. And it's almost like this routine stage of the relationship where it's, you know, this is where we're heading and maybe we do have some similar goals, and if that's the path you choose to go down, it's like it's very routine. And I wonder if some of the questions that start to arise from the routine is, where's the excitement? It's almost like, are we losing some of that mystery and spark? And I find that in that stage, people might compare themselves to when they're in the honeymoon period.
Exactly.
And think that we need to be back with the excitement and the date nights and the going out a lot. And you know, I think that maybe that's a level of anxiety that comes with that stage as well.
Definitely. The disappointment stage comes with kind of settling into reality or daily life.
You might feel complacent.
Yeah, definitely. So then the next stage is kind of like a stage of independence and interdependence. So there's two kind of opposite ends to this stage. For some people, there's a fear that their partner might want to socialize without them, and the fact that their partner wants to do things without them may kind of trigger feelings of insecurity or fear that they don't want to spend time with them or that they're not fun. Or maybe, like you were saying, that back in the initial stages of the relationship, they would do everything together and they couldn't get enough of each other. Now, all of a sudden, their partner has the life of their own and they're not wanting to do things. They're not as inclusive. So that can be a little bit triggering for some people in a relationship when you kind of start reintroducing things you might have done before you entered a relationship into a relationship now that you've established kind of more of that routine. So you might start doing
being friends more,
Even hobbies, activities, things like that
start
for yourself
to bring them back in, because in the first few stages you forget about everything else except for the person. They're the apple of your eye and you want to spend all your time with them. But when it starts to be normality, you know, become normality again and normal routine, you start to bring in the hobbies, you start to socialize again and bring in your friends.
Yeah.
And that can be if the other person isn't at the same level yet, if they're not ready to bring in other friends and bring in the other parts of their life, it can be like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah,
where
definitely.
Are you going?
Definitely. So if that partner doesn't kind of address their own insecurities, they might actually end up in an unintended breakup, because that person can feel like that
rejected,
the other person's pulling away.
They've perceived,
why do they need other things? Definitely. So otherwise the relationship will progress if each person feels content in bringing in different social aspects, different hobbies and things like that. The relationship can actually flourish.
If there's an imbalance, I want to address this with you because this is something we've both been through. In a previous relationship, have you ever felt like you were so busy and had so much going on and the other person didn't? And how did you kind of respond to that?
Yeah, definitely. So that was a really tricky situation and an amazing learning experience for me personally. So I was in a relationship with someone who lived quite far away from me. It was an hour and a half traveling time from door to door. I was also studying. I was completing my master's degree. So studying was quite intense. I was also doing clinical placement.
So you were pretty much superwoman.
Yeah.
Doing about 50 things.
And I also had two jobs. So my time was very limited.
I remember seeing your diary and be like in 2 hour blocks, like where am I going to be in 2 hours of the day? You'd be in like three different places in the same day. You'd be at uni placement and then your partner's house.
Yeah, it was pretty hectic. I was determined to make it work though. I was so in love.
You were.
I was so in love.
You just wanted it to happen. And I think I saw that you put aside your own self-care, you put aside your own friends, you put aside like you just wanted them to feel happy and you wanted to spend time with them as well. But I think you kind of were like, oh, I'm trying to do everything.
My time was so limited. Yeah. I was so time poor so, and I was quite stressed as well. It was a really stressful time for me, academically, work-wise, and then trying to fulfill the needs of my partner as well. I felt very stressed.
And then I was like, don't I go on a holiday? And you're like, oh, great.
All right.
Stress.
Yeah. No, not at all. And he was someone who he would work 4 days on and have 4 days off. That was the nature of his job. And that was basically it, apart from the gym and kind of like a normal social life. He didn't have a lot of other stuff going on.
So he had four whole days off.
So yeah. He had a lot more time than I did. Yeah. And for him, it was a real trigger of insecurity that I couldn't spend as much time with him as he wanted and needed.
And he perceived that as abandonment, didn't he, when you were doing your other things?
And that made him feel really anxious, really insecure, and it actually made him resent me. Mm. And that was the basis of our breakup.
And I could tell that you were trying to keep that relationship together so hard, and so you'd be so tired and you'd drive to his house and just be exhausted.
Mm.
And you'd get there and he might have been angry already because you hadn't written back to a text or something.
Or I was late.
Mm. And he would be angry and you'd be like, I'm so tired. So it's that really imbalance. Mm. And if you're not at the same level as somebody else who has got other stuff in their life, mm, it can be really hard.
Definitely.
To navigate that.
Because it's like, why are you seeing your friend when we have so little time together?
Exactly.
Like he would say to me, I always put you first. But there was that,
thing, because it's like, well, you, other people do need to see their friends. They do need to have time with on their own.
Mm.
They do need to have time going to the gym. That's not a selfish act. That's actually very normal.
And one thing I did learn from that experience is ensuring that you have quality time with your partner, not
just fitting it in
somewhere. Yeah, not just fitting it in somewhere. And that's something that I have to take onus for. So I would, like you said, drive to his place straight after a really, really busy day, and I wouldn't be my best self. I would be tired.
Exhausted.
I would be stressed. I would be exhausted. And our time spent together would be, you know, watching a movie or something together and then falling asleep.
Yeah.
And that was our time together. And I would be like, okay, I've seen him three times this week.
It was almost like ticking a box, wasn't it?
Yeah. That sounds bad. But yeah, I was like, okay, like we've spent time together.
He should be happy now.
Yeah,
yeah,
but it wasn't quality time.
Yeah. And he was probably like, I just want to spend a whole day with you. And you're like, I can't. I've got so much
on. I don't have a whole day. Yeah.
And it wasn't because you didn't want to spend time with him. It's because you were doing so much other stuff. And I think being at the same stage in a relationship, because, I mean, if you're someone who's studying and your partner's not, it's really hard to match that, isn't it? And if you're someone who's working and your partner's still at uni or vice versa, it's hard to explain to the other person that you've got these responsibilities if they're not in it themselves. So that's really tricky as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think timing is really important. Yeah.
Remember how it's like you just need two things, timing and chemistry.
Yep.
And if you don't have one of those, it's like
the right guy at the wrong time is still the wrong guy.
You're feeling re-triggered.
Moving right along. Yeah. So otherwise the relationship will progress to learning how to be a couple and still maintain a level of independence within the relationship. And that's what a healthy relationship should look like. You should be able to spend time together and, you know, have quality time and things that you do together. And you should also be able to do things independently
and not feel guilty,
not have your partner feel left out or anxious or insecure.
That's where an Xbox helps, ladies. Get your partner an Xbox. It can be like amazing.
Yeah, definitely. So the last stage is the commitment stage, and this is where, again, there's two sides to this, where we make a choice.
It's like playing a game. You need to choose yes every single time. It's like a fork in the road.
Move four spots. Yeah. Move four steps and then, you know.
It's like a maze, love, isn't it?
It is.
It's
very
really hard to get to the end point.
Very tricky. So the basic conflicts in relationships.
Harry Potter, when he's in the maze and he gets swallowed up.
It's me.
It's every single person getting swallowed up by the hedge in Harry Potter.
Expecto Patronum.
Moving right along. Sorry.
I digress. Yeah, so there are two sides. The basic conflicts in relationships are often somewhat obscured or put on the back burner if you, in this stage, maybe have children on whom much of the couple's attention is kind of focused on other things. So in the commitment stage, you might have been together for a few years now and, you know, you still have your little bumps in the road, normal kind of conflicts and those kinds of things. But usually by this stage, you also have like other kind of commitments like children, houses, those types of bigger things where our basic conflicts are swept under the rug, maybe. So if no resolution to those conflicts are found and they're not worked on or addressed, relationships do tend to become fractured. Often that kind of, you know, sweeping things under the rug and not addressing basic conflicts leads to a lot of pent up resentment. We often deal with those things with anger and we can feel quite hurt if we don't feel heard and those things aren't addressed.
Or if other things are prioritized above us. Like exactly. If the kids are prioritized, it's a very natural thing to do as parents is to prioritize the kids and their health and their well-being. But to not address your own relationship issues is actually really damaging, not just for you, but for your kids as well.
Definitely. Yes. So love can in that sense turn into this rageful demand for justice. And it can actually lead to some pretty nasty cases where some parents will fight each other through courts and use their children to damage each other. I know we work with children and I have so many clients that I see for separation where they're in really volatile situations where, you know, parents are getting divorced.
And kids can pick up on that. Kids are dumb. Kids can pick up on a vibe really, really well. If they've known their mum and, well, they've known their mum and dad their whole life. They know them back to front. They know their moods. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I would know when mum and dad are fighting, but they wouldn't be telling anyone. But you could just tell. Mm. It was like this tense moment. And that affects kids.
And all that adult information that gets filtered down to children in these situations can be super, super damaging, extremely damaging to children.
Yeah. Because they don't have they're not old enough to have the rational thinking that it's mum and dad's issue. It's a lot of self-blame.
Or the cognitive capacity to understand.
No, they think, I think a lot of children that we see, it's I blame myself for mum and dad because I'm annoying.
Or they feel like they have to pick sides.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, it's really damaging. So I think addressing the issues as they arise is so important.
For the relationship and for the children.
It's a natural protection to not want to involve your kids and to just, you know, put them first. But to be honest, from the other side of things, it's so much more important to address those issues with your partner because it can get way worse.
Definitely. So this stage is where, on the other side, this stage is where the individuals are willing to make long-term commitments. They're like, yep, I can accept you for all you are. I'm pretty happy with the sweet little package I've got. And
fighting is normal.
Normal, yeah.
And you can resolve conflict.
Yeah, if you can fight effectively.
Yeah.
So having successfully completed the previous stages, this couple will have likely built a foundation on trust, honesty, and integrity. And for some, this will result in marriage, living long and happy together. For others, it might just be that you stay in a monogamous relationship. You know, not all happily ever afters look the same. For a successful, healthy relationship, that doesn't mean that you have to get married and buy a house and have kids. There are lots and lots of different types of relationships that are happy and healthy.
And I heard this really cool thing. I brought this up with you a while ago. Is divorce a failure or is divorce the end of a successful relationship? Like is I guess being single now, being a millennial who is in relationships, is it more that it's just a string of successful relationships rather than one person that you spend your whole life with? Because I think that's quite a trend at the moment is I guess people are having more partners at the moment and experimenting and, you know, just seeking out who they kind of like at the moment. And I think that, you know, maybe the natures of relationships are changing a little bit in that there's lots of, you know, chopping and changing. And if it ends, I don't know whether it's due to that maybe we're not good at conflict resolution and we just end it quickly and we move on to somebody else.
Or we think the grass is greener.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's never greener.
It's never greener. It's green where you water it.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, when we were having that conversation, we were speaking about how maybe there is a different relationship for different stages of our life. Yeah. So like we have the young, hot, infatuation kind of romance where it's a lot more physical and it might not be that deep. Or maybe it is. Like I know when I was younger I had some...
It feels deep at the time.
It feels deep at the time, yeah.
It's not that it's like, oh, I guess it's not trivial in the way that it's like, who's going to do the dishes, who's going to do the washing. It feels like you're in so much love at that time.
Yeah, it really does.
It's mysterious. It's like, and I feel like with your first love, you think, I'm going to marry you.
I was getting married at 19. I was like, yep, we're going to get married when I'm 19 on the beach.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and then you have, you know, different stages of your life. Like, I know people that fall in love at 50 and they say they find their soulmate at 50.
Yeah.
So there really is no right or wrong way to have a healthy relationship. No. And that I do believe that there are different stages of a relationship, the different stages of your life. But generally speaking, there are three main phases of falling in love, and there are generally five stages of a relationship.
Mm.
And it's not as predictable as that. And it's
not like this linear curve.
No, and it's definitely complex and multifaceted. There's so much to it, and every relationship is different.
Every relationship is hard. Relationships are hard work.
Hard work.
You can look at, you know, that couple you're saying that never had an argument, but I'm sure it was still work to put in. It was still time you need to spend time. You know what I mean? Relationships are not easy, and you need to continue working on them. Mm. I always like think of a relationship as like a part-time job, because it is. You need to put in continuous work for it, and you need to, like, I guess it sounds a bit clinical, but you need to assess your own performance and yourself and be like, what can I be doing better? How could I do this differently? It's continual. It doesn't just end and you think, woohoo, we're stoked, we're happy now.
Mm.
It's continual, and new challenges come up, like, for every couple. Whether it's just because you're married doesn't mean that challenges stop coming up. Like, kids come up, like, you know, stuff happens, life happens. So I think it's good to just keep working on it and know that no relationship is a walk in the park.
Mm.
The most successful relationships I've seen, people work on it, and they, I guess, both sides take ownership of where they went wrong.
Yeah, that's
it. They fight well.
That's it. Fight effectively. Learn how to argue so that you're, like I said, that attuned thing might, you know, sound a little bit silly and a little bit like, oh yeah, when am I going to just like think of that acronym? But if you break it down, awareness, tolerance, turning towards each other, understanding your partner, being non-defensive, and being empathic.
Mm.
They are six basic things that you should really be working on with all your relationships, not just your intimate ones.
Yeah.
So I do think that strategy can be super effective for learning to argue properly, because we all argue. It's normal. It's healthy. And be aware of what types of the four horsemen you have, whether you have a tendency to be defensive or to stonewall or to criticize. Knowing that about yourself, having that self-awareness will make you a better partner.
Yeah. And I always think I always drive this home, is take ownership.
Mm.
Take, like, I know we brought this up before, but there's a good chance that you've done something wrong as well, or you've done something that maybe you could have done better. And taking ownership is the best step that you can take to start to resolve a conflict.
Mm. Even, and that's how you grow.
Yeah. And I feel like as girls as well, like, I know we had this chat, we tend to want to be the victims and be like, oh, guess what they did, like, it's so shit. It's always good to be like, yeah, but how do you think they feel about that? Like, how do you think the other person feels about that? Okay, so Q&A time. I have one from a really awesome listener. So she said, you guys always talk about self-care, but what exactly is that, and what do I do for self-care?
Good question.
Really, really good question. I think self-care is thrown around a lot, and it's one of those things that you just smile and nod at, like, oh yeah, self-care, but then you're like, what actually is it? How do I care for myself?
Yeah, is chugging a bottle of wine because I've had a rough day self-care?
Absolutely.
Is eating all the greens and walking in the park self-care?
Anything. There's this meme on Facebook and it's like, so what do you do when you're sad? This is what the therapist says, and it's me. Add to cart. The therapist says no. If online shopping is your self-care. I think rule of thumb, anything that isn't damaging.
Yeah.
So maybe drinking might not be the best thing if you're someone who drinks so much that you don't feel good for the rest of the weekend, or you cannot afford to go shopping. So anything that's probably going to affect you negatively in the long run is probably not good self-care. Self-care is something that can affect you positively in short and long term.
Yeah, definitely. So self-care is basically, if we break it down, care for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so, no right or wrong way to self-care.
So it's something to look after yourself that not only kind of nourishes your physical being, but also nourishes your soul, your mental, psychological, physical, your whole well-being. That's how I kind of see self-care. So you want to make sure you're doing things that encompass that whole kind of, you know, perspective of the self. So, for example, things that I actually do for self-care are really, really simple. Really simple. So, something that makes me feel really good is having a really long shower, washing my hair, washing my whole body, exfoliating, you know, shaving my legs. And then once I get out of the shower, moisturizing my whole body, putting a hair mask in, putting a face mask on, and then sitting on the lounge and watching a movie.
Yeah.
That's something that makes me, it relaxes me. I do a lot of deep thinking in the shower. So
I feel like the best thoughts come in the shower.
I have whole arguments with myself in the shower and I come out with a resolution. I'm like, damn, that was good.
Or you have a comeback like from 2 days ago when someone said something like mean. You're like, I've got a comeback 2 days later. Yeah. It's always in the shower.
Yeah, definitely. So I just find that whole process of washing yourself.
Cleansing,
cathartic. Yeah, super relaxing. I make sure I use really nice products, like moisturizing products, things that are going to make me smell nice and feel nice. And then I'll moisturize, get changed into some clean, comfy clothes, watch a movie.
Yeah. I think same for me. I like walks, so I need to be outside. I need to be in nature. I need to be around something that is like natural. I think if I'm cooped up in an office all day, I prioritize going for a walk in the afternoon.
Amen. Yeah.
Because it's like, it's almost for me, it's like getting rid of all fresh the stuff in the day. Yep. And I need, for me, nature is this, you know, what I need. And then, you know, so exercise for me is a really good one. You know what is really good self-care for me is doing nothing, having nothing planned for a whole day. That for me is like luxury to not have to do anything or be anywhere for a whole day. And I have the whole day to choose whatever I want to do is for me the best self-care. So I think self-care, anything that after it's done you feel good, is generally going to be self-care. So it could be you know, pampering yourself, going for a walk, sex with someone or on your own if you like. It can be maybe going for a massage. It could be lighting a candle, having a bath, reading a book, watching a really good TV series on Netflix.
Or trying a new hobby can be really good self-care. Yeah. So if you wanted to, say, for example, take up dancing or try a yoga class or something like that, doing something that you've wanted to do for yourself can be really, really invigorating. Yeah. Can be,
going to the sauna. That is so...
Or the pool.
Yeah, the pool. There's something very relaxing about the water.
The ocean.
Yeah, the ocean. That's really, really good. I love the summer.
Beach. Oh, yeah. I find that really relaxing. Yeah. That's actually... That's my favorite care too. Yeah. I'm very similar to you. Anything outside, nature, beach.
Delicious brekkie, going out for breakfast. Yes, brunch, if you can afford it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or make your own meal. I love having the time to really make myself a delicious meal. So... when you're not just rushing trying to do dinner or pack your lunches or something like that, but when you have just time on a Saturday or Sunday morning to make yourself a really delicious meal.
My version of that, because I'm so lazy. I never do that. My version of having time to make a delicious meal is adding banana to my Weet-Bix. I'm the laziest cook in the whole world. But yeah, I know for you, you really like the cooking and picking the ingredients and cooking and
this, and the smells too that fill your house when you've cooked something really delicious.
If you, or even just like going shopping, window shopping, walking around, like anything that makes you feel good. There's no right or wrong way to self-care. Anything that, you know, really good smelling candle. Love lighting candles. You know what? Buying flowers for yourself if you're a girl or a guy.
I did that the other week, actually.
It makes you just instantly happier.
Brightens the room too. Your environment is another self-care. So making sure that your bedroom or your living space or your office space is making you feel good.
Yeah, so a sensory, you know, looking at your senses, if you're still stuck, you're not sure what makes you feel good, going back to your five senses, so something that is tactile, like a soft blanket, can be really, really helpful, or a weighted blanket for your tactile, for smell, as I said, a scented candle, incense, something, whatever. Listen to music, go outside, listen to the birds, like that is in itself a mindfulness practice as well, and mindfulness is a really good self-care tactic. So...
anything a nice like picture that. Or sitting close to a window.
Going to the movies. Tasting delicious food. Taking the time to taste food.
Mindfully eating.
So, there's no right or wrong way.
We can talk about this forever.
there is absolutely no right or wrong way to self-care. Anything that you know, usually you know what is that at least one thing that makes you feel really
good.
Your favorite thing to do. So yeah, that's what we think about self-care. Mm. We love self-care, fully promote self-care. Mm. If you're feeling tired at this time of the year, and lots of people are.
Or even when you're not, don't wait to practice self-care for when you're feeling run down and stressed. Habit. Yeah.
Do it on your Sunday
practice
morning.
Practice it often.
Yeah, have that time to just do a lot of self-care.
Make it a priority.
So many people neglect their self-care and they end up getting burnt out or exhausted. So please, guys, do not neglect your self-care. It's so, so important.
Go for a walk, eat some food, go shopping, hang out with your friends.
Get in comfy jammies, have a movie.
Have a shower.
Oh, God, we could go on.
Yeah. Anyway, we hope that was helpful. And we hope you enjoyed this episode.
And we will be back. Ames, I really missed recording with you the last time. So we will be back next episode and we'll be
talking about something spicy.
We always do.
We don't know what it is yet.
But it's going to be spicy.
So send us in any suggestions that you have or any questions that you would like answered now that we have this little Q&A segment.
Yeah, anything you guys like. All right, guys, we'll catch you next episode.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you love this episode or you know someone who might, we would love you to share this with them. If you want to see more, please follow us on our Instagram at The Psychology Sisters.
Please note the content shared in this episode is for educational and general informational purposes only and does not replace personalised advice and support from a mental health professional. See you next episode for more spicy science and sexy self-help.